Welcome back, and thank you, Victoria, for opening up another episode of The Felon File for us. Podcast, as Victoria said, where we look at crime and punishment, law enforcement issues, crime stories from the Appalachian Mountains and beyond there. And as usual, our friend Victoria is running the control board for us and doing the recording for us today. And once more, we are coming to you today from the International Podcast Recording Studio located at Scratch Ankle, North Carolina, west of Asheville, east of Ken, and make a right at the light. And we do appreciate everybody for listening in. Our caller stats are going up as far as our international listeners go, Canada, Australia, Great Britain, as well as some interesting correspondence from those locations with suggestions and points of view and ideas for possible Shade of Blue stories that we're looking into and researching. No matter where you're listening from, grab a friend, spread the word about the Felon File. Today's Shade of Blue story, we're going to talk about the killing of a banjo man, the murder of String Bean Ackman and his wife Estelle. About 50 years ago, Middle Tennessee, about 1973, was considered a nice quiet area to live in. Mostly rural, a lot of farmland, a lot of good people. And it was an area of a subculture where people dealt with business from a handshake point of view, a promise, a word of mouth, an agreement. If someone said they were going to do something, they did it. One place in particular, Ridgetop, Tennessee, about 20 miles outside of Nashville, also known as Music City, the best qualities of any small town can be defined in that area. But it hasn't been that way in about 50 years. The incident that changed a lot of perspectives occurred on a chilly morning of November 11th, 1973, when String Bean Ackman, 57 years old at the time, and his wife Estelle, 59 years old at the time, were found murdered on their property out in the country. The killings were the cause of grief, anger, and a developing paranoia that marked an end to, some say, the music industry's innocent era. Now, if you grew up in the early 70s, like I did in the United States, and you ended up working part-time as a channel changer and volume control or remote control for your father, you could watch Gunsmoke, which was now in color, MASH, Columbo, Adam 12, and Emergency, just to name a few. Quality entertainment, even so today. And for laughs, there was the Sonny and Cher show, the comedian show Laugh-In, just to name a few. Combining music and comedy, of course, there was also Hee-Haw. And there were several characters, one of the characters on the program, Hee-Haw. And, of course, the show had several different characters that were either comedians or singers or both, basically entertainers. I had the opportunity to meet Archie Campbell, one of the participants in the show. He attended and studied at Mars Hill College in the town that I grew up in, as well as the comic who was a guest star a lot of times, Mr. Grady Nutt, who autographed one of his books for me. I was in about the 7th or 8th grade at the time. Another of the talents in the show, and the topic of our Shade of Blue story today, like we said, is a gentleman known as String Bean. Ackman was born on the 4th of July of 1916 in the Green Hills of Jackson County, Kentucky. He learned to play the banjo as a teenager, later joining the Grand Ole Opry and hooking up with Bill Monroe and his band in 1943. Not only was he a good musician and a funny comic, but he was also a very excellent baseball player. Now, this too was good as well because you did a lot of different things when you were in entertainment back then. And as one of Bill Monroe's bluegrass band members, you were required to play baseball on his Bluegrass Boys baseball team. Most small towns had their own baseball fields and teams put together at that time. And being on a music performance tour, it was a great way to drum up interest for the concert by playing games against the locals in town where you were performing at. String Bean was very good at this. He was a pleasant, tall, and a gangly young man and a bit of a peculiar person, but not in the wrong way. He was famous for singing songs like "I'm the Man That Rode the Mule Around the World" and "How Many Biscuits Can You Eat?" He performed wearing incredibly baggy shirts tucked into short, tiny pants belted just above the knees, the idea of to make him look taller, skinnier, and more humorous, thus String Bean. He used apple vinegar as shaving lotion and rubbed alcohol on his armpits as a deodorant. He often used the Jackie Gleason expression, "How sweet it is," and he did so much that it became a signature line with him. In an interview, though, he was once cornered by an author who asked him why he used Jackie Gleason's expression, and String Bean responded with, "Well, it was good enough for him, and a lot of my fans don't know who Jackie Gleason is anyway." When Jackie Gleason was asked about this later, he had no problem with String Bean using his signature line. Now, String Bean, when he wasn't performing, he'd slaughter, smoke, and eat pigs, but he had a thing about it. He would not eat anything from a cow. No beef, no dairy. When not on tour, he made extra money hunting wild ginseng and selling it on the Chinese market. String Bean was known to keep wads of $100 bills in his overalls. Having lived through the time when people didn't trust banks, he figured it was a lot safer. He had a habit of flashing wads of money around to his friends. According to one old-time musician, Lester Armstead, who was a friend of String Bean and a neighbor, it is quoted in some articles about String Bean. He was so happy that he was making a living playing banjo that he got to live on a farm doing what he wanted. That's all he wanted to do. Now, he called his banjo, or his stringed instrument, the five, as in the five-string banjo. Asked once if he had medical insurance, he said, "Nah, just me and the five," referring to his way of making money through playing the banjo. String Bean married the former Estelle Stanfill, Kentucky native from Murray County. They got married in 1945 when he left Bill Monroe's band. The couple's best friend were fellow banjo player Grandpa Jones, who was also a member of the cast of Hee Haw TV show, as well as Grandpa's wife, who was a fiddler, a violinist, and singer, Ramona Jones. Ramona Jones recalled String Bean and his wife as very gentle people, sweet, gentle, who loved nature and spent most of their free time fishing or hanging out on the creek. The two couples bought a farm together in 1955. The Joneses lived in a white house closer to the road, and String Bean and Estelle lived in a small cabin just behind the house. The Ackermans didn't have any children, and they had no problem with Grandpa Jones and his wife and family, because he had several children, taking the prominent place, the big white house, as, of course, they needed more room than the String Bean and his wife did. Later on in the late 1950s, the Jones family ended up moving to Washington, D.C. and String Bean and his wife bought out their part of the farm. They took possession of the White House, but instead of living in the White House, they continued to live in their small cabin that was at the rear of the property. Within a year, the Joneses returned to Middle Tennessee and ended up buying a house just down the road from the old farm. In November of 73, when Grandpa Jones was interviewed by a local radio show, he described them as they were just about as happy as a couple as I've ever seen. I think they suited each other the best of any two people I've ever come across. Bluegrass Hall of Fame member Mac Wiseman was also close to String Bean and his wife. We'd sit and visit a little while in that little cabin of theirs, like kin folks did, he said in 1988. I remember sitting on the porch of their cabin and dangling my feet off the ground. We'd ride the car together and travel to appearances and enjoy ourselves. String Bean wore funny clothing on stage, but was always appropriately dressed and nicely dressed in the car with a sports coat and a regular size pair of trousers. And apparently, according to the singer, he didn't pay for those nice clothes. Though String and Estelle would do a lot of squirrel hunting, and they got so many squirrels off of their property that they'd get tired of eating them or fixing them. And George Martin, who was also a Grand Ole Opry star, who didn't hunt, but he did like eating wild game, he would trade String Bean clothes for the wild game. Now, on the night of String Bean's final Grand Ole Opry appearance, he sang Y'all Come and Hillbilly Fever. Then he, Estelle, his wife, and the Jones family, Grandpa and Ramona and their children, Mark and Alicia, sat backstage for a while and talked about the upcoming plans that they all had. Apparently, String Bean and Grandpa were going to go to Virginia on a week-long hunting trip, so their wives planned to have a special dinner together on Tuesday. String Bean was so adverse to eating red meat that he didn't even like the smell of it being cooked, so this was a chance for his wife Estelle to have a nice steak dinner with some friends. String Bean performed again. His next slot of the night came around 10:18 that evening. After this, he changed into his bibbed overalls, his regular street clothes. And it should be interesting to know that his wife had sewn in his bib overalls an inside pocket, and he was carrying $3,102 in cash in that pocket. He put his stage outfit or his costume into a bag, which carried also a .22 caliber pistol. Then he and his wife, who herself was carrying about $2,000 sewn into a hidden pocket in her clothes, they got in their Cadillac, and they headed home. String Bean had never learned to drive while he was growing up, and he didn't need to. He had no car while growing up, and he couldn't afford to have one at first. When on tour with Bill Monroe, he rode in a bus. Now his wife drove him now wherever he needed to go. String Bean also never learned to read or write as well. His wife took care of those matters. And the late night drive home took about a half hour from the Grand Ole Opry to where they lived. And they turned off onto their driveway off of Baker Station Road while listening still to the AM radio broadcast the live Grand Ole Opry, where they listened to Sam McGee sang Worry, Worry Blues. Now, as the Cadillac's lights shone on the front porch, apparently String Bean realized there was something that just wasn't quite right. He told his wife to stay in the car and took his .22 caliber pistol from his clothing bag. He walked alone to the door very carefully, behind which was two cousins, 23-year-old John Brown with his stocking over his head, and Doug Brown, who was wearing some sort of a Halloween mask, both hiding inside the house. According to Doug Brown's later court testimony, String Bean opened the front door and hesitated a few minutes before entering. I'm assuming checking to see what he could see before he entered. Maybe he sensed something wrong. He was, after all, an excellent hunter. And taking in the scene, he stood there for a minute, apparently knowing something wasn't quite right. Slowly, he went further into the house, and he found the cabin had been torn apart. The two cousins, apparently looking for money that they hadn't seen or couldn't find, they figured that if the money wasn't in the house, String Bean must be carrying it. They had known how he flashed cash about, and being local boys, they may have even seen it a time or two themselves. The two decided to wait for the husband and wife to come home after they had searched the house. When String Bean entered, holding the gun in his outstretched right hand, he caught a glimpse of Doug Brown to his right, and he opened fire. And of course, we can second guess all we like to. The cousins might not have killed him if he had not shot his pistol at them. But both were operating on a drug and drink courage line, and their plan was robbery, not murder. But they, unfortunately, were both armed, and armed with String Bean's own shotguns. They had located those in the cabin, as well as ammunition to load them. John Brown had also carried a pistol he had brought with him, and he used that gun to kill String Bean Aikman. The gangly banjo man fell, arms outstretched near the fireplace, or at least that's how his body was found. Estelle, his wife, had slowly been moving from the car and could see through the open door. She heard the shots and saw her husband fall. Terrified, no doubt, she ran towards the main road, screaming for mercy and for help as she ran. This according to the testimony of both of killers at the time. Falling to the ground, she went to her knees, pleading to John Brown, who had run out of the house in pursuit of the fleeing wife. But instead of mercy, John Brown shot her in the back of the head, execution style. String Bean's wife lay crumbled in the grass away from the house, where her body was found later. The Brown cousins searched both the bodies. Apparently, being scared and doing so quickly, they did not locate the thousands of dollars that the Aikmans had hidden in pockets and in their underwear. However, they did find $250 cash that String Bean had in his front overall pocket. They took the performer's bag, his wife's purse, and a couple of the guns they had found, and they rode away in String Bean's own station wagon that was kept at the house for hunting and fishing trips. The following day, before 7 a.m., as had been previously arranged, Grandpa Jones gathered up and packed his hunting gear and drove the 2 miles to String Bean's cabin. As he crested a hill that cold November morning, it struck him odd as there was no smoke coming from the cabin's chimney. He said this was the first indication that something was wrong or not quite right. Continuing on to the house, he found Estelle's body next to a hickory tree. In shock, he yelled for his friend and walked towards the house. Finding String Bean's banjo case on the front porch, he knew this was very wrong. He entered the cabin and found String Bean's body on the floor before the cold fireplace. Quickly grabbing the telephone, he discovered the wires had been cut. Running back to his vehicle, he returned to his house, telling his wife what he had found, and called local law enforcement. Grandpa and Ramona Jones returned to the crime scene, meeting up with law enforcement and local sheriff and police. Ramona Jones later testified that she had noticed that there was frost on Estelle's hair when she looked at her body. She had also noticed that the radio in the cabin was turned on, and it was tuned to the Grand Ole Opry station. Assuming that possibly the suspects, as they waited for the banjo man to return, were actually listening to the program, and possibly using that as an indicator of when they would be coming home. In an interview with the press, Grandpa Jones' wife, Ramona, said, "It was devastating. Our lives were never the same after that." Of course, when you have a homicide, as is typical, the farm was soon covered with investigators, neighbors, and friends of the couple, the curious, the angry, and again, the scared. "They were our best friends, and we liked them so much," several people told the Nashville Banner newspaper at the time. And of course, there's no doubt that being the quiet person he was, Stringbean no doubt would have hated the noise and the attention his farm was receiving at the time. Many wondered if this was the beginning of things to come. Should they be scared? Why did it happen? A lot of the famous country stars began looking at their own security options. Several of them now a little uncomfortable with the easy access they had been giving their fans. A week later, musician Jimmy Widener, who often played on the Grand Ole Opry as Hank Snow's rhythm guitarist, he was robbed, beaten, and killed in a Nashville, Tennessee alleyway. Of course, that didn't help the situation at all. Nashville music had seen tragedy before, like the 1963 airplane crash that killed Patsy Cline, Hank Shaw, and Randy Hughes, famous singers of the day. The plane crash was recorded as a reckless waste, like the pills and booze addled death of Hank Williams Sr. in 1953. But until 1973, it really hadn't known murder of this nature. And now the murder was accompanied by a frenzied press and a lot of publicity. Stringbean had himself taped a whole year's worth of Hee Haw episodes, so he remained a contemporary television star even after he had died. And I remember watching him on TV at that time frame. 50 years have brought changes to Nashville. It is now a metropolis that probably Stringbean and his wife Estelle wouldn't recognize. The investigation ended up in the convictions of the two cousins, John Brown and Melvin Douglas Brown, both 23 years of age at the time. According to the Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals in their court records, quote, "Upon their return, Mr. Ackerman spotted the intruders in his home and offered some resistance. One of the Brown cousins fatally shot him, then pursued, shot, and killed his wife, Mrs. Ackerman." At their trial, fellow TV cast members and his friend, Grandpa Jones, testified. Jones testified that he recognized one of the stolen firearms that had been found in the defendant's possession. The firearm had been a gift he had given Stringbean himself. Of course, in turn, each cousin blamed the other for the homicides. Marvin Douglas Brown fought his convictions in the appellate courts, and on September 28, 1982, almost 10 years later, the Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed the trial judge's order denying him a new trial. In an interview later with the Nashville paper, Marvin Brown admitted his part in the burglaries and the murders, but insisted that it was his cousin John Brown who had fired the fatal shots and killed the couple. Of course, by his own statement, he admitted to committing burglary, and that being a felony itself, and that the conclusion of the burglary ended and resulted in death under Tennessee's felony murder rule. Similar to what many states have, Brown was legally guilty of murder because of his involvement in the felony. It didn't matter who had fired the killing shots. Marvin Brown died of natural causes in 2003 at the Brushy Mountain State Penitentiary in Tennessee, and he's buried there on the prison cemetery grounds. John Brown was incarcerated in the Lewis M. DeBerry Special Needs Facility in Nashville, and in July of 2008, the Tennessee Parole Board defrayed any parole for 36 months. He was again denied parole in 2011. In November of 2014, though, John Brown was granted parole. He was released after serving 41 years of a 198-year sentence. At this time in 2014, he was 73 years of age. In the 1990s, it was reported that about $20,000 in deteriorated and unusable cash had been found behind a chimney brick in the Ackerman's cabin. Although a lot of people don't believe this was connected to the family, if it was true, as it was reported that detectives had searched every inch of the place and looked under every rock and stone they could find. A year after the murder, String Bean sideman Kurt Gibson went to work for Hank Snow, replacing guitarist Jimmy Widener, who had been killed in that Nashville alley. The murder had cost Gibson one job, and he ended up gaining another after the second murder. With Hank Snow, Gibson went to play there at the Brushy Mountain State Penitentiary. In the style of Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison and San Quentin shows that other stars were doing similar concerts at prisons at, it was thought it was a good publicity stunt. One of the Brown boys was assigned to carry the sound equipment in and help with the setup of the stage. When String Bean's friend found out who he was, he stopped him and told him, "I used to work for String Bean. Him and I were very close friends. I want you to know that String Bean was a very forgiving man, and if I could say anything from him to you, it would be that he'd want you to do something good to help others." And soon after that, Hank Snow discovered that the Brown cousins would be in the audience, and he canceled the show, refused to go on stage. 50 years later, String Bean and Estelle Ackerman are remembered as people of simple kindness. They were killed for greed and for meanness by desperate people. But while they were alive, they were contented people, secure and unworried, and would step up to help somebody who needed it. Hopefully they rest in peace. Indeed, they lived in peace. Would only that they had died that way. Well, that's our Shade of Blue story for this weekend. I hope you found it interesting. Remember, in the coming weeks, if you have the opportunity, follow String Bean's lead. Do something nice for somebody. It's really the right thing to do, and if more people did it, we might end up having fewer Shade of Blue stories to relate. At least modern ones. We're still going to have stuff from the old days. All right, Victoria, go ahead and close us out. We appreciate you all for listening. Don't forget, if you would like, you can check out our webpage, scottlunsfordauthor.com, and you can pick up Felon File t-shirts and coffee mugs there. You can also go to felonfile.com and find direct links to the podcast, and feel free to forward that web address over to friends and see if they'd be interested. We'd love to have them listen. Don't forget, be safe and be secure in the coming weeks. And we'll talk to you guys again on another Shade of Blue story here on The Felon File. Victoria, you got the control board back.